Well, a very good morning, all you lovely people out there, and I bet a whole bunch of you are wondering, who is this handsome new preacher we have? Well, it's me, it's Steph. I've just had a haircut. And so I can just imagine what some of the remarks and comments are out there, and none will be as wonderful as the first one I got when I won't name that person, she shall remain nameless, when I came and showed her my hair. I think it was, oh, you've cut your hair. And so the good news is it will grow out, and hopefully it will grow on you, and who knows, maybe I'll just keep it like this for a year or two. Anyway, the timing wasn't that great with winter and the cold, and so if I'm wearing a beanie or a hat, it's not because I'm ashamed, it's because it's a little bit cold. And so as we get going this morning, I am excited to share once again and to share God's word with you. But this morning's message isn't an exegesis or this profound word digging deep into God's word as much as it's a bit of a philosophical, pondering and musing kind of message. And with that, I want to come and set the platform with the question of, Do you ever wish you knew then what you know now? Do you ever wish you could go back to your 20-year-old self and go and give yourself a bit of advice based on your life experience and what you know now? And so I can imagine there'd be a few people that we'd avoid. You know, that guy at Akerstadt Mall all those years ago. You want to avoid him, Steph. And that girl in high school, you want to avoid her. And there'd be a couple of things you'd want to maybe buy. You know, that property or Tesla stock. You know, you'd want to maybe go and pitch in and buy those things. Or some things to avoid, like Steinhoff stock. And even then, some things to avoid, like that lamb and gravy pie at Kensington Golf Course all those years ago. No, just avoid that thing. Don't go there. That was terrible. And so as we set the basis for this morning, I wonder in your groups if you could take a moment and discuss that. What advice would you give to your 20-year-old self with what you know now and the experience that you have? And maybe some of it would be light-hearted, but hopefully there'd be some serious comments that would come up there around some of the advice you'd give your 20-year-old self. Why don't you do that now and discuss in your groups? So I was recently asked this very question. What advice would I give to my 20-year-old self? And after going back and forth over a few light-hearted and serious ideas, I eventually landed at a book that I'd read some time ago called Adam's Return: 5 Promises for Male Initiation. And it was a book that I found profoundly helpful. And so the developed world is in a mess. Just coming back from the US and the UK now, I see how big and bloated that place is, and that culture is, that they have everything and they have so much, yet it feels like they have so little, and they have so little joy and contentment in where they're at. And so for all their sophistication and all their development, it seems like they have created newer, more complex and severe problems that are harder and harder to deal with. And it seems like there is a depression evolution that is busy happening, that the world is developing so fast, especially technology, that the human mind and the human psyche cannot keep up with it. And so in some ways, the world has become too developed for our human minds and psyche, that we're still something of an old world mind living in a new world context. And I don't know if we should be trying to speed up our development and to catch up with the world around us, or if we should be slowing down and taking stock of some old world truths that have been lost upon us and lost upon even the culture that we find ourselves living in. And so this book, Adam's Return, speaks about 5 promises that are common to mankind that all of us are going to face. And in many ways, the Kool-Aid of the culture, the milk that we've been drinking from the culture, has been such to come and tell us a very different story to these 5 promises. And these 5 promises are, for some of us, going to be hard for us to hear, but they are actually good things for us to come and to hear. And so I recently read a book about these people that were investigating prisoners of war, and those that made it through and those that didn't. And you would think the ones that made it through were those that were these eternal optimists that were saying, yes, we're going to make it. Today's the day. We're going to be rescued. And it was actually them that failed first, because they had these high moments of yes, and then And then there's the letdown, and then the high and the letdown, and the high and the letdown, and the high and the letdown. And eventually those letdowns come and just encroach upon them that they can't carry on anymore. And it was actually the realist that said, I'm here for the long haul. This is going to be a long, tough road, that actually survived and made it to the end. And in the same way, there's the danger of us being these glass half full, eternal optimists, living in a haze of optimists. Yes, everything is going to be wonderful kind of people. When sometimes we need a dose of realism, of reality. And so with that, there are these five promises that this morning I want to go through. They're not my promises. They're not anything I've come up with. I've shamelessly stolen them from the book. And I want to talk through them and put them in your hands and let you kind of stew over them, so to speak. And so for some of you, especially in the more developed, comfortable context that you live in and you've grown up in, these are going to be jarring. But for others of you that maybe haven't had as many comforts and that have had to battle and suffer, you're going to be like, yeah, I know that. And so without any further ado, let's jump straight in. And so promise number one that we need to know and that we need to be reminded of is that life is hard. And so the culture is creating, the culture around us in the developed, in the civilized world is coming and creating a context where we come and we avoid pain at all costs. We come in, we disguise it, we avoid it, we do whatever we need to do to get away from it. And so there's billion-dollar industries that are created to come and do exactly this. The pharmaceutical industry, the entertainment industries out there, even if it's just for an hour or two or for a week, you know, there are these industries that come and help us escape from reality. And so in South Africa, we come and we build our houses. People like myself, big houses with big fences and intercoms, and we come and we hem ourselves in and we create a buffer between us and some of the absolute abject poverty out there and the suffering of people. And we have no idea of the suffering of people that we walk past each and every day. And so by and large, I feel like I have been sheltered. And many of us may have been sheltered, not just from the hardships and the sufferings out there, but with this idea that life is meant to be easy and that it comes to us, and it creates something of an entitled generation. And so I don't know about you, but I think that I have at times and can still be entitled. And so do you know who was entitled? King David. He was entitled, standing on his roof, looking over and seeing another woman that belonged to another man, that was another man's wife. And he comes and he imposes himself upon her and feels entitled enough to come and take another man's wife. He comes and takes something that was not his to come and take. And in the same way, we can be an entitled generation that feels we deserve stuff that actually we don't, and that is not ours to come and take. And that's as a result of thinking that life is easy and missing the fact that life is hard. And so our culture is so good. I want to be careful here, because I know there's some people listening that for them, they know that life is hard. But for those of us that are living in this bubble, we live in a bubble that comes and medicates us and helps us escape and avoid pain and suffering. And so life is hard. And so when I was 22 and I went out looking for a job, and for 10 months I couldn't find work, I was surprised. I thought it was going to be easy. I thought work was going to come to me. And when I found my first job and I sat in a little office that was actually a renovated garage on the property of a private person, and I sat in that office all day long from 8 to 5, and I sat there by myself with no one else typing out reports, it was brutal. I thought work was supposed to be fun. And over the years, when I had more month than I had salary and I dipped into my credit card, you know, I thought it was going to be easy. I thought there'd be oodles of cash, and there wasn't. And when I got married to Cass, unbeknown to me, she had different thoughts and ideas and dreams and opinions that were different to me. And I was surprised by that. I think I might have thought that I was God's gift to Cass. And when we had our first child, and she was stillborn, and I held her lifeless body in my arms, I was surprised by that. I thought stuff like that didn't happen to people like me. I'm ashamed to say. And when we had Tandia and Poppy and Frankie, you know, these little kids crying, moaning, needing attention all the time, and my perfect little ordered world gets disrupted, and I love my sleep, and there was no sleep to be had. And life became very hard in those moments, and I did not expect it. And so my 20-year-old self, I'd go back to him and I'd say, you would be well served to be reminded of the promise that life is hard. Life is hard. And so it's a strange thing as we come and we look and we consider. I was chatting with someone the other night who made the point that they were visiting in a village somewhere in Africa with a man living in his house with his family on the floor. And that man, he bought that family some apples, and he said, oh, this is the first time he's bought apples in, you know, the first time he's had apples in years. And he asked why, and he said, well, I need to buy basic foods. I can't afford the luxury of an apple. And so such was the poverty of this family. And I asked that guy, I said, when you stayed with them, were they depressed? Were they sad? Or were they happy and joyful? And he said, they were the happiest people I've ever met. And there's a strange thing that there are these people that have absolutely nothing, yet they have a profound joy. They've come to terms with the fact that life is hard. And so I think God comes and puts pain in our way to come and shape us and mold us. And so we don't handle pain as much as pain comes and handles us. And God uses that in some shape or form to come and to shape us and to form us and draw us unto himself. And so have you ever stopped a moment and considered the symbol of Christianity is a cross? Many of you wear it on your necks. Many of you have it hanging on your walls at home. And yet, have you considered the fact that that symbol is a symbol of pain and suffering and the hardships of life? And that's a symbol of our faith, that Christ came through suffering and he endured the hardship of life for our sake. And so when we come and we consider this, James chapter 1 verse 2 tells us that we should consider it a pure joy when we face trials of many kinds. And so if you just think of that for a moment, the next time you face a trial, that you lose a loved one, or you don't have enough money to buy food, or you're dealing with relational discontent with other people or fallout, consider it a joy. I mean, what a mind shift is that for us that comes in and helps us find joy in escapist forms. And here God is telling us to find joy in our suffering. It's a mind bender. Why should we do that? Well, consider it a pure joy, my brothers and sisters, when you face trials of many kinds, for the testing of your faith develops perseverance, and perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete and not lacking anything. And so, what's the action point here? Well, Crayhead, come and befriend suffering. Befriend it. And so, that's the first promise. The second promise that life is going to come and throw at us, that we have to come to terms with, is that you are not that important. You are not that important. And so in the face of the culture that's out there that's saying you are wonderful and you are amazing and you can do whatever you want to do and you can have whatever you want, this is a hard thing for us to swallow. You know, we can come and say, yeah, yes, I'm not that important. But down here in our hearts, I don't know if we can come to terms with that so quickly, because in the developed world, we live in a world that comes and tells us you're so important. And so Alcoholics Anonymous is probably one of the few organizations in the world that comes and tells it how it is, that comes and tells you you're actually selfish and you're a narcissist at heart. All of us. That's the problem of mankind, is that we're selfish and we're narcissistic by nature. And so ancient cultures had elders and masters and gurus and wise men whose job it was to come and deconstruct the ego of the next generation, to come and destabilize the false self. Because we're built with this, we've got this built-in pride and arrogance that comes and thinks we're more than we really are. And so Jesus was so good at this, at coming and destabilizing the false self, of coming and deconstructing the ego. And so when he goes and says to the rich young ruler, go sell all your possessions and give that to the poor. Or when he comes and he says, leave your father and mother and come and follow me. Or when he comes and says, what profit a man to gain the whole world yet lose his soul? He's coming and waging war against the arrogance and the hubris and the false self that lives inside of us. And so you are not that important. I look back at my 20-year-old self, at how arrogant I was and how much hubris I had. And I thought I was God's gift to the world. I thought I was God's gift to Kaz. I thought I was God's gift to the church. And I shudder to think, and I know that's still living inside of me, but I think I'm a little bit more self-aware today. But Steph, you're not that important. Crayhead, you're not that important. And so I remember many years ago, I must have been 22, and my predecessor, Pete, was when he was still leading, he'd preached a preach around desiring leadership and eldership. And after the message, I went up to him and I went to him with the good news that I would bless him with, that I desired eldership and I wanted to be a leader and I wanted to be an elder. And I said, excuse me, Pete. And he was tall, looking up at him, and I said, Pete, I desire eldership. And I remember him like looking down at me, and he said this, his words verbatim, he said, Steph, I just don't ever see it happening. And then he turned away and walked away. Now, to this day, I don't know if Pete, I don't know if you meant that, like you didn't see it happening, or if it was just a masterstroke of a guru, of an elder, of a wise man coming and deconstructing my own hubris and arrogance that lives inside of me. And so the difference between humility and humiliation is that humility is something that we embrace and we do to ourselves, but humiliation is something that is done to us. And it's way better to come and humble ourselves than to be humiliated. And so you are not that important. Promise number two. And so what is my action point in this? Well, Crayhead, come and humble yourself. Guys, come and humble yourself and realize that you're just not that important. Promise number three. Life is not about you. And so the culture comes and says, you need to do what makes you happy. You need to do you. You need to come and follow your dreams. You know, in fact, that second one just kills me. You need to do you. Oh my goodness, what is that? What does that mean? And so I think of helicopter parents. You know what a helicopter parent is? It's a mom or dad that kind of hover around their kid and just make sure that they're always there, always protecting, always making sure everything is okay, everything is perfect, and not letting anything ever happen to them. And they helicopter parents that grow up to raise these children that come to think that the world, their parents, their colleagues, their comrades, their friends, the entire world orbits around them, and that they're the center of their universe. And so Copernicus was the guy who came and made the discovery that the earth is not the center of the universe. In fact, the earth orbits around the sun. And for this blasphemy, he was killed by the church. And there's this idea inside of the church, even way back then, that the earth and that mankind and lives inside of us, that we are the center of creation. And yes, we're the pinnacle of God's creation, but we're not the center of God's creation. No. We do not and should not expect God or anything else to orbit around us. But we should come and orbit around God in reverential awe and make Him the focus of all our attention. And so I remember being in England many, many years ago when I lived there. And I was going through a tough time. It was a dark, hard time for me. And it was my birthday, and no one there knew it was my birthday. I worked at a school. No one there knew it was my birthday. No one wished me happy birthday. Later on that day, I got this wonderful phone call from my parents wishing me happy birthday, and I then went and had dinner by myself, and I went and hopped in the bath by myself. And it was in this moment that I realized that I wasn't the center of creation, that it wasn't all about me, that I am actually not that important. And this is so important because many of us live our lives trying to create our story and our glory in our story. And as long as we do that, our story is just going to be so small and so insignificant. But as soon as we realize that we're not that important, but that we get to come and be a part of a bigger story, and that there is something bigger to tie into and to connect into, that's when our lives become alive. And that's what happened in England all those years ago, as I sat there by myself realizing, I'm not that important, and that it's not all about me, and that the world doesn't revolve around me, but that there's a bigger story that I get to come and be a part of. And I think sometimes what we try and do is we try and make it about our story. But if we try and cram God into our story, it's like cramming the entire ocean, all the oceans of the world, into a 2-liter Coke bottle. But actually what we should be coming and doing is taking the 2-liter Coke bottle of our lives and pouring it out into God's story and partnering with Him. And as soon as we give ourselves to something bigger than ourselves and our own little stories, that's when we come and we begin to live to a fuller degree. You see, life is not about you. And so Christ has to be the best example of this. If anyone could have made it all about himself, it was Christ. And yet he came and he gave himself again and again to the bigger story of God's plan, to the bigger story of salvation. And so Christ is the best example of this. And so what is my action point? What is our action point? Well, Crayhead, Steph, come and give yourself to something bigger than yourself. Come and give your story to the bigger story. Come and buy into what God is doing and partner with Him. Promise number four, you're not in control. And so we're a bunch of control freaks, man. I think it's one of the biggest problems in the world and one of the largest leading causes of anxiety is the fact that we live in this idea that we are in control. And there's everyone saying, take control of your life. You determine where you go. And so we come and we look at arranged marriage in the context of, let's say, India, an ancient cultural practice that we're like, you can't come and tell me what to do. And yet, in our context, in the Western context, where we come and see this as controlling and not being able to work, it's embraced and it seems to have worked for generations and generations. And there's a simple turning around or perspective here that we could come and ask. And so in India, they ask the question, who do you want to come and to set the tone of your marriage? Do you want the naive generation that's just starting out to set the tone of your marriage? Or do you want the experience of the previous generation to come and do that? And so my point is that there is a generation there that come and give themselves, abdicate the control, give themselves, and it seems to serve them well. And so we live under this false sense of control, that we have control. And so did you ever have control over when you were born or who you were born to? And do you have control over when what the stock market does or how your spouse feels or when you are going to die? And so you are not in control. You are not in control. I remember when a man stole my parking in Acrestep Mall and I confronted him for a full 5 minutes from the parking to his office and he just laughed me off. It was so humiliating, actually. I didn't have control over that. I mean, maybe I could have upped it and started a big fight or something like that, but that was a big wake-up call to the fact that I didn't have control, and me getting so upset over a parking spot. I feel, can we just edit this out quickly? Because I don't actually want people knowing that. I remember holding the lifeless body of my firstborn. The delusion of control. I had no control over that. And I constantly have to fight that thing of controlling everything, whether it's in my house or at the refinery or in the garden. Or exactly how I want people to respond to me, whether it's at work or at home. And so I constantly have to remind myself that I cannot tell people what to do. I can simply tell them, give them advice, and it's up to them to decide what they're going to do. And so, Steph, you are not in control. You are not in control. And so once again, we come to Christ. And we look at him and we see there that when he's arrested, he comes in and he says, do you not know that I could call upon I could call to my father and he'd send a legion of angels? There is absolute authority and an ability to come and control that he abdicates and he lets go of. Or when he comes and he says, and he's breathing his last breath, "My Father, why have you forsaken me?" Even Christ comes and lets go. And he takes his hand off the steering wheel and he allows God to come and direct and to lead. And so even Jesus comes and demonstrates this, where he volunteers to let go of control. And so the action point for me, Crayhead, Steph, come on, just relax. Don't be so intense. Don't be so serious. Don't sweat the small stuff. You're not in control. And finally, promise number 5. You're going to die. You're going to die. You know, that's not something anyone wants to hear, is it? Well, certainly in our context, in our culture, we avoid it. Death in any of its forms is the great human enemy. And so a person, especially in the developed world, comes and constructs their lives to come and avoid it and to delay it and to deny it. And so the world is getting better at living longer. The world is getting older with each new generation. The world is getting better and better at avoiding death. And so how many times have you seen a dead body? I'm not talking about in the movies or anything like that. I'm talking about in real life, a lifeless dead body. You know, it was into my 20s before I saw my first dead body. And it was jarring and shocking. And so the vast majority of funerals that I've been to, there's no body there, and it's very prim and proper. There's no body to shock the crowd, and it's very short and sweet. We don't want to dawdle on this. We don't want to spend too much time on this. We just want to move on. And that's in the context or in the contrast to some cultures that take days or even weeks or even months to process a death. And so recently, in the shocking death of Sarah Hart Brown, Kaz and I made our way up to Zimbabwe, to the Motopos, to go to the funeral of Sarah. And we got there and we were shocked to see the coffin out there. And it just wasn't what we're used to, especially out there in this beautiful, rugged bushveld. And you're standing there, and it was this kind of shocking moment that then we went over after some time and we lowered the coffin, and then we all took time to put sand on the grave, on the coffin, and to fill the hole. And then we came and we gathered stones and packed those stones on there. And something that began as really shocking for me became so cathartic, and a process by which to come and to think through and process Sarah's death. And there was the beginnings of healing in that process that happened. And I think we gloss over death at our own expense and at our own cost. We don't think about it, and we don't come to terms with the fact that we're all going to die. You are going to die. Just last year, I was going off trail off the Helderberg, and I got stuck, lost, and ended up in a ravine and jumped on a rock and was 25 centimeters from a puff adder that was about to strike me, that was huffing and puffing away. And if I got bitten there, I was over. There was no cell phone signal. I was 2 hours away from getting to anyone. You know, there are these moments where we face death. Death is very, very real. And so, Steph, you're going to die. Folks, you are going to die. Now, there is a turn of phrase that talks about the firstness. And the firstness is this idea of experiencing something for the first time. You know, you think of experiencing pizza for the first time, or a little baby having chocolate for the first time and the delight on their face. And that's an element of firstness. And yet it's much more than that. It's the firstness of going, like I did earlier this year, into the mountains and finding a little hidden away water sprout with red daza lilies in that I'd never seen and never known about. And I felt like I was the first person to find this, and it's the first time I'd seen it, and there was something beautiful in it, and it tore back the curtains of the mundane and the ordinary and came and drew me into something that I experienced for the first time. And it just lifted, it buoyed my spirit to God. And there's something about the firstness of life that draws us to the lastness of life. That in those firstness moments where I come and I, I discover something in the mountains that draws me up to God, and I'm, wow, God, this is beautiful. It comes and connects me to God. And it's that firstness that prepares us for the lastness, for the next life, that in these first moments we discover God's and God's hand in creation that then comes and girds us for the next life and what is to come. And the irony is that we come and we live such self-protective lives that we don't want to do anything that could jeopardize our lives or our plans, that we avoid any such encounters of the firstness of these spiritual moments of discovering God's hand in creation or in nature or in life, that we live so self-protected lives that we don't actually live like we have been designed to. And so the problem with death is not finding the courage to die as much as it is finding the courage to live now, because as we live now, we come and we engage with the God who created all of this, who we would go to in the next life. And so we come and we consider Christ, who did not consider this life something to hold on to and to grasp to, but he came and gave himself in death. And if death was something that was something Christ could expect, how can we come and avoid it ourselves? And so, Crayhead, you're going to die. And folks, you're going to die. But the good news is that there's something more to look after, to look forward to after this. And so just before I come and close, I'd love to land this in a discussion where in your groups you would come and just discuss and open up and chat around these five promises that we can all look forward to in this life. And I say look forward to because the sooner we come to terms with them, the better, the more joyful and profound this life is going to be, and you're going to enjoy it to a deeper degree. So won't you discuss that now? Great, well done. Well, as I bring this into land, I want to make a few final comments. The first of which is that with this message, by no means do I want to come and belittle or undermine or take away from anyone's pain or suffering or hardship that they have faced or are busy facing. I don't want to do that. As much as I want to come and give you handles or give a help or fire in your bones to come and to be able to endure it. And secondly, I also want to come and make the point that I don't want to come and pretend like my challenges and the things that I've faced are bigger and better or worse than any of yours. In fact, I feel like mine pale in comparison to some of the struggles and the challenges that many of you have faced. And then finally, I also want to come and bring some balance that we can walk away from this and say, well, if I'm not important, then I'm a worm. I'm good for nothing. I don't matter at all. And that's not what we need to come away with. And so you might not be as important as you think you are, but you're still important to God, still important enough for God to come and say, you're precious in my sight. I'd give Egypt and Cush in exchange for you. You're precious enough to God that he'd come and say, I love you so much that I'd give you my only begotten son to save you from your sins. That's how much God loves you and how precious you are to God. That's how important you are to God. And so let's not go to the other side where we think ourselves a worm. In the contrast, God loved the world so much that he gave his only begotten son. His only begotten son who endured a hard life, who was overlooked as unimportant, and who didn't make his life's mission his life as much as he came and made his life's mission his father's mission and gave himself to the bigger story of what God was doing in the world, and who came and gave up control and who came and died on a cross for us. He embodies this fully and completely. And maybe I can leave the final word of this message to the Apostle Paul in Philippians chapter 2, verse 3, where it says, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant. Being born in the likeness of men and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross.